What is it, Martin?
A reminder that the BBC interview with the Duke of Windsor is coming up soon. Now, we understand the Duke is no longer in the best of health. Might be worth visiting when you go to Paris.
Certainly not.
Go on, Martin.
It's just a slight concern that if the BBC interview were to go down well, following the successful visit of Emperor Hirohito, the question might be asked, if the Japanese make the effort to visit him, why will his own family not?
Because he didn't cause them offence. He didn't abdicate the Japanese throne or kill the Emperor's father. For the last time, no. That man is shame. Like the stench of livestock.
Sir?
It seeps into the woodwork and never goes away.
Welcome to The Crown, the official podcast. I'm Edith Bowman, and this is the official podcast for the third season of the Netflix original series, The Crown. Taking you behind the scenes, speaking with many of the talented people involved, and diving deep into the stories. Today we're talking about episode 8, titled Dangling Man, written by David Hancock and Peter Morgan. In his 1944 book Dangling Man, American author Saul Bellow describes a man who is waiting to be drafted into the army. Whilst he faces death in World War II, he believes that this is the only way to give meaning to his life. In this episode of The Crown, Prince Charles likens himself to the character as he describes what it's like waiting to become king whilst at dinner with his new love, Camilla Shand. At the same time, the dying Duke of Windsor contemplates his life's meaning, having given up the crown in 1936, choosing love over duty. We'll be talking in depth about the events in this episode, so if you haven't watched it yet, we suggest you do so now or very soon. Coming up later, we'll meet Erin Doherty, who plays Princess Anne in The Crown.
I've never played anyone like her before in my life, and she's taught me so much about the woman I want to be. She's genuinely, I think, just made me a better person.
We'll also hear from costume designer Amy Roberts.
So my little trick is to look and look and look at all those people and then put it all away and just do your own thing with it.
But first, I talked with Sam Donovan, who directed episode 8 and 9 of season 3 of The Crown. I asked him about working with acting royalty Geraldine Chaplin and Derek Jacobi to portray the elderly Duke and Duchess of Windsor in Dangling Man.
Phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. Oh. I worked with him a few years ago on a show called Last Tango in Halifax, so we'd already had an experience of working together. And when I knew he was casting, I was just like, this is, yeah, an absolute dream.
And it's a different situation we see them in as opposed to when we, you know, back in seasons 1 and 2, in terms of this old couple who almost live in this museum of the crown in a way. Do you know what I mean? It's just kind of extraordinary to see them, how they are, and Geraldine Chaplin as well.
Geraldine Chaplin was wonderful. We put a list together of people to play Wallace, and Geraldine was top of our list. So she lives in Switzerland, and she flew over to us in London to have a meet, and she turned up with these big, chunky trainers on, these skin-tight leather trousers, this really funky, colourful bomber jacket, baseball cap and big dark glasses. I mean, she looked like something out of Salt and Pepper, you know. literally the coolest 75-year-old you've ever met in your entire life, and carried it with such confidence and really didn't care. And then when we sat down to chat with her, she was really lovely and understood the character. And, you know, and she's kind of American royalty, you know, with her father being Charlie Chaplin. She's she has that. And also she spent a lot of time in France, you know, which is where the Windsors ended up after the abdication. Yeah. So it felt like she understood the world and understood that character.
We must throw a party. Our greatest ever party. And concentrate only on happy things. To that end, let's cancel the Japanese emperor.
Hirohito? No, we can't do that. No, too much planning has gone into it. Besides, it may be my only remaining opportunity to restore my reputation. Oh, reputation is an idle and most false imposition of God without merit and lost without deserving.
the Duke of Windsor has a really important role almost within this episode, where he's almost like a mediator between Charles and the Queen. You know, it's known that him and Charles wrote to each other.
Well, they're actually very similar characters, really. I mean, they, and this is, I think, what the threat was for the Queen, but, you know, he was very much a free thinker, he was curious, he was slightly rebellious, and at the end of the day, he put love before duty, he put love before the crown. And I think the thing with the Queen was she kind of had to give her permission for Charles to meet him, because how often do you get to meet a former Prince of Wales and a former king?
Yeah.
You know, any advice that the king in waiting can get from somebody that's been through it, he should take.
We were just watching some real footage of the Duke and Duchess, and, you know, I think it's only a few years before he passed away.
Mm.
These interviews that the BBC did,
yeah,
that are up on online and stuff, and it's incredible to watch. And,
yeah.
You almost, even the way they sit, they can't, it's like they can't get close enough to each other. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They need, there's almost, even just the angles of their bodies are constantly directed towards
each
other.
Yeah, we looked at that video, even though it's not written word for word. You know, Peter's done his own version of it for the good of the story,
yeah,
that we're telling. We did look at the body language with Geraldine and Derek. You know, we watched all those interviews together and looked how she would reach over to him and he would touch her, and the big comforting moments, and, you know, this just longing look from her all the time as he's speaking and he's opening up about how he feels. You know, it's beautifully done.
Everybody wants to know how much of what's in the crown is true.
Yeah.
And the way that Peter writes it, it's like you believe everything because it's within the confines of the stuff that we already know.
Yeah.
And particularly, I think, in episode 8, that meeting with the Queen and the Duke.
Yes.
Which happened, but we don't know what was said.
We don't know what was said. We can only guess what was said.
I hope they said what you said.
I hope they said what we said as well. And
the crown always finds its way to the right head.
To the right head.
What a line.
I know. And it does. He wasn't right to be king. He's, you know, at that time when he abdicated, you know, we were about to go into war and they needed a strong, sensible head of state, which they got with the brother, you know.
Yeah.
So it does always find its way to the right head. And when we were shooting that scene, Derek's performance in that, I mean, Derek just doesn't hold back even in, you know, director's rehearsal, never mind when we're turning over. And this was one of these moments where Olivia really had to fight back the tears, you know.
Yeah.
And then we did a crew show afterwards, which is basically where everybody comes in and watches the scene, and then we tell everyone what we're kind of into for the rest of the day.
Oh, that's amazing.
So kind of how it works is that we have director's rehearsal first, which is basically me, the DOP, the first AD, and the script supervisor. And we will block the scene, then I'll talk with the DOP about what angles we're gonna shoot, how we're gonna cover the scene, essentially how we map it out from a visual storytelling point of view. We then talk to the first AD to make sure we've got enough time to do what we want to do. And if we don't, then we figure something else out quite quickly. And that can be either changing the shots or asking the actors to change the blocking a little bit. And then we do what's called a crew show, which is where then everybody piles in the room. Everyone's kind of squashed in corners. I mean, on The Crown, it's not so bad because the rooms are generally massive and there's room for everybody. But we all kind of squeeze in and watch the, you know, and watch the scene. And there was not a dry eye in the house with that rehearsal. I mean, the way Derek coughs and splutters and really struggles that scene, and you knew that this was going to be the last ever meeting between the two of them, and the regret, and in a weird way, the respect that they have for each other was just breathtaking.
And then there's that moment as well, which we know happened as well, is when he actually died and his dog jumped off the bed.
Black,
that's extraordinary.
Yeah, Black Diamond, the pug. Wallace knew that he'd passed when the dog jumped off the bed. The animal's sixth sense, you know.
Wow.
It was really important for us to kind of get that in and use that as a visual metaphor.
I underestimated you. We all did. But the crown always finds its way to the right head. My father, my brother, you, and one day, God willing, your son. The You don't think he's up to it?
I never said anything of the sort.
But you think it. I can read you every bit as well as you can read me. And I know why you think it. You can often appear weak, indecisive. But with the right woman by his side, I say he'll make a good king. And his thoughts have already turned to the matter.
We're introduced to this dilemma then, this love dilemma between Charles and Camilla before we get to Diana, you know. Yeah. So it's almost kind of like going back to fact check about things. Yeah. As well, which is extraordinary.
I mean, a lot of people don't know about the fact that those two have seen each other before Diana was on the scene. Mm. You know, I think everybody thinks that Camilla was trying to snaffle
the femme fatale.
Yeah. And because she really wanted to become queen. Mm. And that is not the truth at all. I think Camilla's thought of being queen at the time was the last thing she wanted. You know, she was a party girl and she liked to go out and have fun and was into her country pursuits, and actually was happiest when she was at a country home, pottering about in the garden, riding horses.
Watching the polo
and having a G&T, you know.
That was one of your first things you shot, wasn't it? Polo.
So we had to, so I was supposed to start prep, I think, in October, and they called me in earlier to shoot the polo match. So that was quite a challenge because we had to have Josh O'Connor looking like he could play polo.
Canny.
He trained very, very well. I mean, he had quite a lot of sessions with the polo players. He couldn't ride a horse before, so he
not even ride a horse.
No,
wow.
Never even been on a horse, I don't think. So
it's like hockey on a horse, isn't it?
It's exactly like hockey on a horse. Yeah. And actually, he was okay in the end. Andy Buchan, who plays Andrew Parker Bowles, on the other hand, had just had a baby. His wife had just had a baby, so he's that busy looking after the kids, looking after newborn.
Yeah.
And was just not in any kind of state to be learning how to play polo. So he tried, but he just wasn't at the level that we kind of need him to be to make him look like he's going fast. So the clever people at the horse company have got a horse that is a fake horse that's on a quad bike.
This is amazing.
So so Andy was sat on this horse, and they had to change the hair for it as well, because polo ponies have different type of hair. So there's a mad kind of panic getting this horse kind of dressed properly. And then as the quad bike is going along, the horse is kind of moving up and down as if he's riding it. So we could get all our close up coverage on Andrew, and we could get all our close up coverage on Josh, who was doing the horse for real. But they couldn't play it at a quick speed, which we needed. So we got good doubles in. But I just watched I, Tonya, where they'd done all Margot Robbie's face replacement for the ice skating. Yeah. So I said to Ben and Reese, our VFX guys, what are the chances of, you know, in our big wide shots and mid shots, can we, you know, we're going to be able to replace the faces?
Face on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't see any other way how we can sell this scene without your help. And anyway, after a bit of head scratching and research, they did it.
Amazing.
And they pulled it off. Yeah, and it works really well. And also, you know, setting up Camilla for the first time.
Come on, sir.
A tussle for possession now.
Go on, Your Royal Highness, sir. You can do it.
Yes, it's Windsor Park. Windsor Park pushing up once more.
So apparently Emerald loved series one of The Crown and got in touch with, or agent got in touch with Nina and Robert, the casting directors, and said, if Camilla ever comes up.
No way.
I absolutely adore Camilla and I would love to be in the room for it. So we obviously, you know, we cast, we auditioned a lot of people and did chemistry tests with Josh and all that. And slowly but surely, Emerald worked her way to the top. Yeah.
Because it's wonderful, because we also get to see this side of Charles as well, this kind of practical joker side of it, really playful side.
It's really playful. And I think that's why they fell in love. They shared the same sense of humour.
Yeah.
They were really into the goons. They were really into practical jokes. Camilla apparently has got quite a filthy mouth with her jokes, which compared to the straight jacket that Charles is usually in those kind of quite stuffy environments, to have someone like Camilla who just tells it how it is and is quite rude and coarse and hilarious and witty all at the same time was just an absolute delight for Charles, I think.
How am I going to be able to persuade you to have dinner with me? issue a royal decree?
I can't do that. I'm not king.
Yet.
Yet.
Then just say please.
Please.
There are many hugely talented creators behind what we see on screen in The Crown, and most of them are based at Elstree Studios, which is where the custom-made sets and carefully sourced props are housed. It's also home to the impressive costume department, where I was lucky enough to spend some time with costume designer Amy Roberts. Amy, thank you for being here to talk to us about your wonderful world of costume. I think if I had to choose one department to spend my time in, it would be going back to your costume department, because I had the absolute joy of spending a little bit of time walking about. It's my favourite.
And all those terrific girls that work in there.
How much of a team do you have?
Well, the regular team that are making all pretty much all the costumes that you see, the Queen, Margaret, everybody's made. It's a kind of smaller roles that you'll source or get made outside. But those girls are making all that. So every time you see our major character, female characters, it's literally made from scratch.
With season three, at what point did you start working on the season and how did you start?
Probably started about 3 months before we actually, our first shoot date, which sounds like a lot of time. You kind of wanted double that. So I started by endless research, because you do have with the royals, which is a gift and also a worry, so much visual reference. So my little plan, trick, is to look and look and look at all those people and then put it all away and just do your own thing with it. And hopefully you've got maybe the essence of the Queen or Margaret. Otherwise, I just feel we're not bringing anything fresh and new to it. And there are moments where I think you need to recreate the look, like the Queen Abervan.
Yeah.
Or a Jubilee. Royal wedding or the Jubilee. But even with that, I think it's just like a nod to it.
Yeah. You have to think about the actor as well.
Totally.
In terms of it being, you know, it almost being tools for them to find the character and find their performance, really, in a way.
Yeah, just because the Queen looks great in orange doesn't mean to say Olivia Colman looks great in orange. You don't, it's as simple as that, really.
Yeah.
It's just finding your way along with the actors, I think.
And a wonderful opportunity as well to explore characters over a time,
absolutely,
a big time period.
Completely. Season one and two, you had that, which was done so brilliantly by the two designers on that. But it was a kind of war, post-war, that palette, which is always slightly more somber. And then suddenly I'm got the job of the 60s. Which, all right, it's a sort of subtler version than Carnaby Street, but the colours are there. I was very struck by, when I did my research, that the pinks and orange and pastels and were so, so different. And I think, for me, like a lot of designers, probably it's all about colour. It's a huge project. So many of the characters, like all our makes, they're like little dolls almost. And that the other layer of people, like your mums, Abervan, and the politicians or the smaller people in the story,
staff actually, the palace,
are as valuable and as important. And maybe I quite like doing them a bit better, probably.
That's interesting. Why do you think that is?
Because doing Margaret or the Queen, it's just lovely fabrics. It's great. It's fantastic. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But I don't know how deeply you get into it. Whereas Alice or, an Abervan mum, you've got to get that right. Otherwise, you've let let them down, haven't you?
Yeah, totally.
But it's weird, isn't it? I've only just thought about that, the levels of all the characters in The Crown.
Yeah. And it's interesting because there are so many big female characters in this, family drama.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask about when you're approaching dressing the men and looking at the design of the male costumes, is it harder or is it easier than the women? Because like you say, with Margaret, you kind of know where you can go with it, I guess. Yeah. But with the men, are you slightly more restricted? And
I like men's clothes very much. In a way, you feel with men, they have that uniform, don't they? Of their suits, their beautiful, impeccable suits, which again have all been made.
Incredible.
Charles, slightly old-fashioned, isn't he?
But it's even just you saying, Charles, in the way that his suit's designed is slightly old-fashioned to reflect.
Yes.
That's a real subtlety, but it's really important that, it's those subtleties, I think, that can make a really powerful impact.
I hope so. And little things, like just for Josh, when he goes to Wales, and we found an amazing tie with daffodils on. Again, you probably won't see that, but so he wore the daffodil tie when he was in Wales,
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have to look back and have a look at that.
Yeah, so little things like little secret things I think are nice,
But that's the brilliant thing about it is how enormous this project is, but how intimate and how personal the performances and the emotions that you have as a viewer to them. Like Geraldine Chaplin, who plays Wallace Simpson.
Geraldine is this delicate, tiny little creature. And of course she's a very fine actress and she will embody a Wallace, but in a different way.
I guess there's an element as well of even once you've fitted and the costume is perfect for that moment, for that scene, once they get on set and there may well still be adjustments to be made to things, or is it once they're on set, that's it kind of like it's locked
down? It's kind of that's it, that's quite a story. Because one of her dresses was going to be where she lies on the bed with him.
Yeah.
And I'd done a sleeve, which was like a dragon's fin, like that. And I, in my head, had imagined she would put her arm up like and around his head. So you would see this amazing shape of the sleeve all pleated and it would look amazing and the light and everything. Well, that never happened. So I was very kind of cross about it and said to Sam that he was missing a trick, Sam being the director missing a trick. He just looked at me and laughed. Wasn't about my sleeve at all. So you have to stop it and not be indulgent sometimes, you know?
It's incredible to think how much of it is made though. And what happens to it after?
Oh, now this is amazing because most jobs, it makes me laugh, the angst and worry you put into a costume. And then it's either, I don't know what happens to it, it either goes sold to a costume house and ends up in the fifth person in the 10th row in a big film. But with The Crown, they're all stored and they go on display in museums and exhibitions. So what's so brilliant, because the workroom girls on my episode, it's couture standard. So their work will be seen by loads of people.
That's amazing.
Close up. All Sid's buttons and fabrics, and it's all going to get another life, which is so rare.
Another character that I absolutely love in season 3, and I'm really excited to see where that goes, is Anne.
Yes, and she's cool, isn't she?
She's great. But again, it's almost, I feel like I've learned more about Anne in season 3 of The Crown than I knew about her as a person. It's a wonderful exploration of her as a person.
Yeah. Of all the royal women, she's the surprise, isn't she?
Yeah.
Both what she wears, jeans, pea jackets, to really amazing hats and 60s
real
coats
style
and dresses.
Yeah.
Your Royal Highness, may I present Captain Andrew Parker Bowles?
Hello, Andrew.
Your Royal Highness.
What are you staring at?
At you, ma'am.
And how much you've...
I advise you to choose the next word very carefully.
Flat.
Oh, you mean the dress. It's the Queen's. I look like a hydrangea.
Yeah, I mean, developed. Grown up.
Evidently, I've gone from invisible to visible.
No, you were always visible.
But somehow you'd never seen me.
Now we'll hear from someone I've been dying to meet, Princess Anne herself, actor Erin Doherty. I asked Erin about getting the part.
I was doing a play at the time and I got a phone call from my agent and I was like, oh, okay. I got off the phone and I was like, find the crown. I knew what the crown was, but I had no idea who Princess Anne was. I genuinely was a bit like, I don't know.
Which one's she?
Yeah, I was like, who are we talking about? So I went away and did research on YouTube because there's loads of stuff of her on YouTube.
Did you watch her on Wogan?
No, there was one. What was it? Was it Wogan or was it Parkinson? I think it was Parkinson.
Okay.
She tells a joke at the end of it, basically, and it's the best thing in the world. She's funny.
Yeah.
I think that's when I like properly fell in love with her because I was like, I'd never seen a royal tell a joke.
Yeah.
I'd never seen it. So I was like, oh, she's...
There she is.
She's different. Yeah. I really felt for her as well because I was like, I'd never really... I'd grown up and I wasn't really aware of the royal family. They were just kind of there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't expect to have this strong reaction. So I went in for my first meeting in January and I found out I got it at the end of April. So it was like
a long
of time. Yeah. It was not relaxing, but I was very, very relieved that it went my way.
It's been great talking to all your colleagues about you as well, whether it be Jane LaPaterre, you know, grabbing the cigarette out the ashtray, all that kind of thing.
That was her. She was like, now, do you think she'd smoke? And I was like, I've never really thought about it. And she was like, I think you should smoke. I was like, okay, come on then, Jane, let's do it. She literally took me. She was like, we're going to do this. And I was just happy. She just took the reins. She made that scene.
And then there's so many moments I could literally name them all, but there's even bits where she doesn't say anything. It's just a noise sometimes, but that says so much more than words could say almost, in terms of a disdain for something.
This is what I mean. Yeah. I've never played anyone like this woman. Like, I honestly, like, I love it. I love the scenes. Like, when I get the scripts through and everything, I love those group scenes where I know I have no lines because I'm like, this is great for me. It's like a free-for-all for, like, eye rolls and grunts, and you know she's going to be doing it. So I'm like, bring it on. I love those scenes.
What about the voice?
That was... Well, the first time I searched her and watched her YouTube,
is it easy to do?
No, like it took me a long time. Like I've never heard anyone speak like this.
She doesn't move her.
She doesn't move her lips at all. Josh always laughs at me for this. He's like, "Oh, we're going to do a scene." No, and I'm like, "Yeah, whatever, Josh." She doesn't move it. She doesn't move her lips. Like he takes piss at me all the time, and I'm like, "I'm being Anne." It's such a low. It doesn't feel natural. You can see the kind of odd control that she's like got over this voice. So it's, in a way, when I do it, it gets me into her psychology because it makes me really angry, basically, to put it bluntly. Like whenever I do it, I feel really like controlled and really like I'm going to explode. I want to scream or I want to do something, but you just can't. Mm. And it's kind of like the epitome of the royals. Like she has to be this way. You can feel that she has something else to say, but she's not allowed to do it. So it manifests in this weird, swallowed, low, not moving lips voice. Yeah. And I love it. It's like its own character for me. Like it was the key to getting into her and to understanding her. So I feel like you can tell a lot about someone by the way they speak.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, right, well, that's all I need to know then.
I can see perfectly clearly who you are and what this is. And I can assure you I'm not going to get hurt. Now, what's it going to be? A resumption or a cessation?
Of what? A resumption.
Fine.
Where'd you get it from at your age?
What?
Oh, come on. That confidence. Mm-hmm.
I'm not confident, dear. Just tough.
How important are all those other departments as well, be it, you know, your Amy in costume and Kate in makeup and the props and all that kind of thing? How important is all that to have this kind of, I kind of refer to it as like almost like a toy box of things and kind of tools to help?
It's everything. They've built Buckingham Palace. Like, the whole of the outside of Buckingham Palace is, like, there with a big, massive green screen. You're like, okay, someone's done that. Like, Christ. And then, you go to a costume fitting and Amy and Sid are there and they've built these suits and dresses from scratch. And you're just like, this is... These people are incredible. And the fact that they have all taken so much time and put in so much effort to do their job as best they can, it's the most inspiring thing. You just want to be part of the team.
We had a lovely chat with Amy. She was very sweet and she talked so highly of you and told us a great story about cashmere.
Oh my God. Oh my God, right? Have you ever worn cashmere? Jesus. I had never worn it. Oh my God, I was in a costume fitting. They were like, right, okay, let's try this one. They didn't preempt it. It was very casual. I was like, okay, fine. Blue jumper, whatever. Put it on. I lost my mind. It like slid on to my body. I was like, what is this heavenly material? It was amazing. And it was a turtleneck as well.
Oh, nice.
I know. So I was like just covered in it. I was like, this is amazing.
I can't not ask you about the hair as well. And what does that involve?
She is that hair. That hair is her. They are one. It's a magnificent thing. But it is like...
It's a magnificent thing to have to wear, though.
Well, when it's on, great. When I'm doing the scenes, great. The process of getting it done is so intense.
Okay, talk me through it.
Well, you just can't... So, like, most of the time you rock up to set and it's, like, 5 a.m. and you sit down and they just start backcombing your hair. Honestly, backcombing, like it's no tomorrow. And then sometimes they'll put rollers in and then sometimes there might be a piece or sometimes that's it. But then they have to like smooth it into this like crazy lion mane.
It's like a sculpture.
It's honestly, and you just have to sit there, have coffee. It takes hours. It takes hours.
Episode 8, Dangling Man, where, you know, it's that kind of weird... entwined mess that's going on and stuff. And I didn't even know all that stuff about Anne and Andrew Parker Bowles.
I had no idea.
Like, this is saucy.
I know. But then at the same time, I'm like, come on, of course. Like, look at her. Yeah. Like, for one, like, she's going to want to go out and, like, have a good time. She's a teenager, basically. Yeah. She's just wanting to throw stuff at a wall, see what breaks, see what people say about it, for starters. Like, yeah, what are you going to do? Yeah. Like, I think she's just so... She's just willing to make a mess and see what her family have to say about it. Because I don't think many people... I think she sees her brother so frightened about the response of these people. Mm. And she's a bit like, well, come on. Like, they are also human beings. She's just so willing to push people to their limits.
Yeah.
How was it? The candlelit dinner. Come on, there are no secrets in this place.
Lovely. Thank you.
Camilla Shand, eh?
Yes. You're seeing her ex, Andrew.
Not sure you can call what we're doing seeing. Not sure you can call him an ex, either.
Camilla told me. He's definitely an ex.
Hmm. Just make sure things remain the right way around. Us playing with Camilla and Andrew. Not them playing with us.
What you've got is these brother and sister who are each other's kind of soundboards for their life because they don't have that relationship with their parents.
Yeah.
So Anne is having to seek out her brother saying, look, don't get yourself into a tiz here. Like, you need to know what this is. And I think it's especially weird because she's in the relationship that's making it so entangled.
So
the fact that she's saying, look, here's the situation, whilst on the other side of things, she's going out or having a good time with Andrew, it just highlights the weirdness of this family. Because I think Anne, ultimately, she puts her brother first and she's going, look, I know this is going to be weird for both of us, but I don't want you to get hurt. So it's great for me because it's also a really... It's an honest moment of showing how much she values her brother and her brother's feelings over how awkward that conversation would actually be.
And how much Charles trusts her.
Yeah, I think they really do have a special relationship. Kind of, it had to be created because of that lack of parental support.
Yeah.
it again, whenever you see these people's fragility and real just absolute care for each other, it takes you back, because you don't see these people, you don't see their heart, because they're this stone family. But the moment you give them heart is really important, I think, and you get to do that with Anna Charles.
Will you be sad to leave Anne behind?
Yeah. Like, it's something that I don't think I will think about until it happens, because one, you kind of, there's so much going on that you physically can't, but also I don't want to think about it. I don't want to let go of her, because she's meant so much for me in terms of my life and what she's given me, but also as a character, like I say, I've never played anyone like her before in my life. Mm. And she's taught me so much about the woman I want to be, the human that I want to be, and what I value in human beings. Mm-hmm. She's genuinely, I think, just made me a better person. So to think about letting her go and going that deep into another character, whatever it may be, is a sad one. Yeah. That's a sad thought.
You must be so thrilled, though, with the response that you in particular have, because so many people have been kind of pulling out your performance and the kind of the presence that you've really kind of real impact that you've had. You've got to be chuffed about it.
I in a way, it sounds really cheesy, but I'm just chuffed for Anne. I'm just so glad that, like, people are saying these things about her, because that's kind of what I'm most happy about, is that hopefully people see her and have seen her in a new light, because I think she's really bloody brilliant. And, like, especially for her to be on our screens in this day and age, for women in particular, I think it's just really wicked.
I'm Edith Bowman, and my special thanks to our guests on this episode, Erin Doherty, Amy Roberts, and Sam Donovan. The Crown, the official podcast, is produced by Netflix and Something Else in association with Left Bank Pictures. Join us next time when we go behind the scenes of episode 9, when Prince Charles gets some poignant life advice from Wallace Simpson.
I'm sorry not to see your girlfriend.
She's picking me up after this. We're spending the evening together before I return to Dartmouth, but don't tell anyone. It's a secret. She's not official yet.
Is she the one?
Yes. I think so.
Then if I may offer two pieces of advice. Never turn your back on true love. Despite all the sacrifices and all the pain, David and I never once regretted it.
Thank you. And the second?
Watch out for your family.
Well, they mean well.
No, they don't.
Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.